Accession number 28756, Reel 1.
So this is Doug Allen, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Ealing, in London, in 1924.
What did your parents do for a job?
My father was a time-serving man in the RAF, who joined the RAF as an AC plonk and finished up as a squadron leader. And I travelled the country with him. There was only me then. And we travelled all over at different RAF stations at that time. And then I went to India when I was 6 years old with him and spent 3 years in India when my eldest sister was born.
So it was a service, very much a
service family, yes.
What do you remember of, say, the early years of your childhood in India?
Well, I remember that my father was, although he was only a corporal in those days, we had three servants. We had a cook and a housekeeper, and he had his own bearer. Very little schooling. Very little schooling. I remember the monsoons in particular. They used to be horrendous when they came. And one thing that sticks in my mind was my poor old mother. She hated it out there. She couldn't stand the spiders and the things out there that nearly drove her up the wall. But my happy moment was when my young sister, my sister was born. She was 8 years younger than me. And she was born out there. But she was a nice surprise.
Can you remember where the bases were that you were in, or were you in one base?
Well, I was in Quetta. I was stationed in a RAF camp in Quetta. We lived in Marrow Quarters. My father was a member of Five Squadron, Hawker Hearts, they were in those days, open cockpit planes. And he was a gunner in the back. But I remember it quite well, really. It was a great time, really, because I pleased myself what I did, really. You know, there was the other children in the camp. We played together, and that it was quite fun. But
there was no school?
Very little schooling in those days. They used to take us by a lorry to into a place where a lady who had been a teacher at one time taught the children from the Marrow Quarters. But my education was very lax in those days.
And you were what? I mean, you must have been, what, about 12 by then?
Well, no, well, I was 6 years old when I went out there, and I came home at 9.
So you came home in 1933?
Yeah, about that time.
Before the big earthquake in Quetta, there was a
good... Yes, that's right. We came home before the big Quetta earthquake, yes. So prior to that, prior to being in India and Quetta, my father was in Iraq. But in those days, no families were allowed out there then. Because they were still having trouble out there in Iraq in those days. And when he moved to India, excuse me, we were able to join him. Went out on the HMS Somersetshire and came back on the Dorsetshire.
What was the
voyage? Troop ships.
But did you travel in comfort?
Well, we went up through the Bay of Biscay, and I'm very rough. And it wasn't bad, you know, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad at all. But, yes, those are the days. And, of course, I kept travelling round with my father to these different RAF stations. So I was always on the move.
And I mean, coming back to England in 1933, it's the time of the Depression, but your father's got a good job in them.
Yes.
What do you remember then of that sort of period post 33, say up until you came back to an English school? What was that?
Yeah, I came back to England, and we were living in Louth in Lincolnshire. And I went to school in then, in those days. It was all right, you know. I mean, times were hard, even for the people in the services. I remember I used to have to go down to the farms to get vegetables and stuff like that for the family, and milk. They weren't very good days in those days, I'm afraid. And my father, which of course, we never saw much of my father at one time or another. He was always moving on, going to different places. Excuse me.
Were you conscious of, as the 30s progressed, of the growing threat from
Germany? Yes.
Did your father talk about it?
My father used to say that there was trouble coming. And he said that he could see there would be trouble between England and Germany in the end. The way that they were carrying on and out there in Germany, and the way they were treating the Jews and that. And he said, I can see trouble coming. And of course it did. My first job, I remember my first job, when I was 14 years of age, I had a first job when I worked for a squadron leader, De Salis. It was gentry. And he lived in a big house, and I used to cycle 10 miles a day in the morning and start work at 8 o'clock and 10 miles home, and I finished at 6. And I got 10 shillings a week, of which I gave my mother 5 shillings. And I had a half, 2 and 6 for a new bike, and 2 and 6 penny money. And I worked for him quite a long while.
What were you doing?
I was his gun boy. I used to, my first job in the morning when I got there was to pump water up into the tank with a hand pump. And then most of the time I just went up in the loft and change the apples around. I used to have to turn the apples and go into the room where the pheasants were and make sure that the jugged hair and all that sort of thing. I'm mucking it, it's just stink rotten. But I used to enjoy it when we went out on shooting, because I was always able to take open a couple of pheasants for the family. So they were good days, and we always had beer and cheese and what have you for lunch when I was on the shoot.
So this would be 1938.
Yes.
You left school at 14. You didn't want to go on.
No, I left. I left school at 14, I got this job. And then, of course, I put my age up and joined the army at 17,
which would be in
1942.
Hang on a second, I'm out here. You were born in 24.
Yeah, but I put my age up and told them I was born in 1923.
In which case, I want to go back to, say, in 1934, you were 10. When you were 14, which was 38, you worked for this... He was a colonel, you said?
Squadron leader.
Was the job your father had arranged, or...?
Well, yes, he had, yes.
So from 1938, you're 14, when you're 16, you join up. But you say that you're 17. I just wanted to go back to the years of the beginning of the war.
Yes.
What you remember of that, and what your father said, and how you were conscious of, I mean, what aircraft you saw around and where you were. That period while you were still working as a gunboy.
Well, yes, it was. Of course, the aircraft were improving all the time. But living on RAF stations, I did see a great deal of the aircraft and the bombers that came into land there. We knew there was a pending war. Everybody knew that there was going to be a war starting at some time or other. Generally, the population took it in their stride, I think. But us kids, war was something, I don't know, when's war going to start, which is a terrible thing to say. From my experiences later, I realised what I did say. But it was all war games. When we were playing, it was war games. Some had to be Nazis and some had to be the British troops. But it was hard times in those days. They say the good old days, but for the general population, it wasn't all that good.
What do you remember of the declaration of war itself in 39?
I remember that Chamberlain going to the last-ditch stand, as he said it was, that he was going over there. And he came back and he said that his efforts had failed and that there would be war. And from then on, it was just... well, I don't know. It was different. Because the people were getting called up all around. Troops were going away, leaving families behind. And I just thought that I wanted to... When I was old enough, I'd be there. I'd go.
What about your father? Was he was off with his squadron?
Yeah, well, he was... He stayed in England all the time, actually. By this time, he was the chief armament officer. And he was in charge of about 15 RAF stations during the war. And he'd done bomb disposal and stuff like that. We never saw much of him. He was on the move all the time. He had his own little... van and a driver to drive him down all the time, so never saw much of my father. When I did see him and I said that I was going to join the forces, he said, well, I hope you're going to join the RAF. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, you know too many people in the RAF and I don't want no favours. I said, what I achieve in my service time will be achieved on my own back, not yours. And that was a bit of a tricky point between my father and me for a long while. I don't think he ever forgave me for not going in the RAF to follow in his footsteps. But when I joined the forces, my intention was to join the Navy. And I went down to... I was living in Oxford then.
Still working as a gun boy?
No. I left that job and I was working in a factory by this time. My father had moved on and we were now living in Oxford. And I got a job at the Press Steel at Cowley, Oxford. We were making munitions. And by this time I was getting a bit fed up. I wanted to go and do my bit.
So now you're about 15 or 16.
I'm coming 17.
You're coming up towards 17. And yeah. Can you remember, I mean, just briefly what the experience of working in a munitions factory was like? And this would have been in 1941.
Yes. It was all hard going there. We worked long hours. We started at 8 and sometimes finished at 8. We'd done a 12-hour day. I was on manufacturing mines, the cases of mines, and I was working on a power press with four of us, two each side of the big power press, two putting the sheets of metal in, two taking out the shaped cases. And it was a big factory turning out all sorts of things, ammunition boxes, shell cases. It was a munitions factory, so it was turning out all this different stuff. And I was on night shift for a while, and I didn't like it at all. I thought, well, I must go and do my bit.
Do you remember any bombing going on? Was there any raids?
No, not in those days. No, I don't remember anything about the raids in those days. They were not in Oxford anyway.
These were the black years of the war, weren't
yes,
they?
Yes.
Things
yeah.
were really not working well.
No.
Kirk had happened. The Americans yeah. weren't yet into the war.
No.
So what was the atmosphere? I mean, was this one...
Oh, people were very, very up patriotic, you know, and everybody stuck together. That was one thing I found about the war, even in civilians. Everybody stuck together. They all helped one another. One didn't have, the other did, and they looked after each other very well. But, of course, I went into the forces and I didn't see a lot of what was going on in civilian life after that. But I know they had shelters in the gardens and things.
And fifth columnists and...
Oh, there was notices everywhere. Dangerous talk costs lives. And it was on about the fifth column. People that lived in the country for years were fifth columnists. And sometimes you were suspicious of somebody doing something that they was out of the ordinary. And everybody thought, oh, it's a fifth columnist. But I don't know, people got on with their lives and tried to do the best they could.
So you finally decide to join up. You're not
yeah.
quite old enough. So
yeah.
Can you talk me through the process of how you joined up and why you didn't?
Well, yeah.
You were going to go to the Navy, but you didn't.
Well, I went down to join the Navy.
And this was in Oxford?
This is in Oxford. The Navy Army and Air Force recruiting office. I wanted to join the Navy. And they said, where do you work? What's your occupation? And I said, I work at Cowley. And as soon as I said I worked at Cowley, they said, I'm sorry, that's a munitions factory. It's a reserved occupation. We can't take you. I'd already told them I was 18, which was a lie because I was only 17. Anyways, I went back. And the next day, I took another day off. I went down to the recruiting office and I went into the Army recruiting office. And they said, where do you work? And I said, I work for the council. Oh, they said, that's all right then. And within 4 days, I was reporting for duty. It was as quick as that.
Well, I mean, I'm always curious about, didn't they want to see a birth certificate? Didn't they want to see...
Nobody asked me for anything. I did not get asked for a birth certificate or anything else. I just said I was 18, and they said, that's all right, and take the King's shilling, which I did. And I reported for duty and was posted to Northern Ireland.
So you actually took the King's shilling? That was actually done
yeah,
as a process?
Yeah, the King's shilling, yes.
I haven't heard that described before.
You're going to fight for the King, and you're going to take the King's shilling. It's an old army saying of King Shilling.
They don't physically give you a...
No. It's just you're taking the King Shilling. And I was posted to Northern Ireland.
What did they say at your place of work when you said you were going away to fight?
Well, they said that everybody was very happy for me, you know, and... I didn't get into trouble for not reporting for 2 days. And they said, how did you get in? Because you're not old enough. And I told them that I'd put my age up. And they said, you must be determined to go. I said, well, yeah. I'm determined to fight for my king and country. Which was always been my ambition to be in the forces anyway. But not with my father. And that was that. I'd made some friends there, and they were sorry to see me go, but I made more friends in the army than I ever, true friends, than I ever had in civilian life. Because I think in the army you are, is really true friends when you're in the army, because you're all there to look after one another. And I was in Northern Ireland.
All right. So now you take the King Shilling within 4 days.
Within 4 days, I was reporting for duty. As quick as that.
And how did you report from a duty? You went down to the station, and there was a...
Yeah, I had a travel warrant, and I went down to the station. I went over to Northern Ireland on the boat, and joined the battalion over there, the Ox and Bucks. And
what was the name?
Oxford and Buckinghamshire Infantry. And I was over there in Donegal D. There was still trouble over in there in those days. Down the Falls Run, they were tar and feathering people and stuff like that. And there was explosions going off now and again. But then I wasn't over there a great deal of time when we were told that they were asking for volunteers to join the 1st Airborne Division, which was being formed.
Just before we get to that point, what was your basic training like? Were you part of a draft that came in?
Yes, I was part of a draft that came in, and we went through our general training, square bashing, and all the other things that you do when you're training to be a soldier. You're learning to use your arms properly and on the firing range down at Carrickfergus and done all that sort of thing. Army exercises where you went out on exercises and that. But in general, just general stuff for the army stuff.
How did you find the people that you were with? What was the kind of social mix?
They were very good. They were quite all different kinds of people. Yes, it was all from different parts of the country. They were a nice lot. They were a pretty good lot. But there was some poshy there, we called it poshy. There was all sorts of people. There's one bloke there was a gypsy, couldn't read or write. And Bertie Roach. And he actually came with me when we joined the airborne. Yeah, dear.
These people were colder? They were conscripts, or were they like you?
A lot of volunteers. A lot of volunteers. Majority, I would say, were volunteers. And they were all volunteers in them days when they first formed the airborne. There was volunteers. It was all volunteers.
The people training you on that basic training, your first, they were what, old sergeants? What kind of background were they?
They were regular soldiers. Regular soldiers, and we had two or three regular officers, you know. But the sergeant majors and the sergeants and that, they were nearly all regulars. And they put you through the, until you passed out, you know, and you were okay then, you were in the battalion. But it never really started to get hard. I found it very easy. And it never really started to get hard until we came back to England when we joined the 1st Airborne Division.
So there was a call out for volunteers. How did you find out about this?
It was put up on the orders. Came up on orders that anybody wishing to volunteer for the formation of a new division, which would be the 1st Airborne Division, put their name forward to company headquarters. And they got up a draft, and we came over from Northern Ireland with an officer named Lieutenant Sweeney, and he brought the draft over to England.
How many people volunteered?
There was 30 in our draft. And
was there a movement, God, why are you volunteering for that, or never volunteer, you know what people say?
Oh, yes, they did, but it was a chance to get back to England for one thing. And it was in my way of thinking, it was a chance to do something different. And I knew that it was going to be hard work, but I was ready for it. And as I say, we came back to England with Lieutenant Sweeney, and it turned out that I was put in his platoon, and I stayed with Lieutenant Sweeney for the Normandy landing job. Until he got wounded. But that was when the hard work really started.
So now we're in the end of 1942. Where, what time?
Beginning of 42.
Beginning of 42.
Yeah.
You joined up at the end of 41, is that
right?
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember the month?
I can't remember it now, to be quite honest with you. Without going through my details, I can't tell you.
Okay, so then you come back to England in early 42.
Yeah.
To join the first... come
back to join the 1st Airborne Division.
And where was that based?
The Pulford Camp in Salisbury Plains. And that was our base then, right the way through until the end of the war, when we came back to England each time. That was always our base. Always went back to Pulford. And then we were on a... When we came to Pulford, we were on 1 month's trial. And during that month, we'd done forced marches. We'd done 10-mile run and walk in so long. And every morning before we had our breakfast, we had to fall in outside and do a 5-mile run in boots and shorts. And in generally, it was a pretty tough course. Route marches of 25 miles was constantly on the go, full equipment.
How much would that have weighed?
Full pack. About 50 or 60 pounds, I suppose. And we went all through this. And at the end of the month, over 50% of that intake were returned to unit. The remainder of us had got through and had been assessed as airborne material, were then issued out with our favourite Red Berry.
Can you, I mean, going through the first month, what was the one aspect of that you found the most difficult?
I think that the march, the 25 miles forced marching, because it was really horrendous, really. And that's when a lot of the people that were taken in on that intake fell out. And if you fell out, you was out.
And it was a 25-mile walk without a march, without break.
Well, you go 10 minutes stop every hour. That's all. Yeah, so you'd done 25 miles.
And you'd be walking in step? You'd be actually marching?
I'm marching in the group, as a group. And anybody that fell out formed a slow party, and they brought up the rear. And it was pretty hard. The other one that was very, very hard was the 10-mile one. You had to run for so long, then you march for so long, then you run for so long, then you march for so long. And it was pretty hard. But we were all determined to get through, the ones that wanted to. I finished up with a good crowd of boys that I knew you could rely on. And if you ever got into trouble, you knew that they were there to back you up.
Was there in that time, that first month, was there any parachute training of any sort?
Glider training, no, nothing like that. Because I was in gliders. After the first month when we finished that off, then we started introduction to gliders. And we should be taken to the aerodromes, and we'd load up and we'd take off and land and all that sort of thing.
Tell me about the gliders, actually. I'll just...
Right, the gliders...
Sorry, Doug. Doug Allen, Reel 2.
The gliders were... the ones that were used to transport us were Horsa gliders. I'll show you one later.
These were made of wood?
They were plywood, literally plywood. They were called flying coffins in them days because they reckoned a lot of undertakers were employed to make these things.
How big were they?
Oh, they're massive things. I cannot think how big they were. Now that's about a wingspan of at least 40 odd feet. Well, it took 29 men and all their equipment and the hand carts, which we carried all the ammunition in one load. There was a smaller one, which was called the Hotspur glider, which was only used for training, and that took 8. Then there was a Hamel car, which was used for transporting small tanks, cars, jeeps, stuff like that. And then there was a Wacko, which was an American glider, which was made of tubular steel and canvas. Not a very nice thing to ride in. But from then on, for quite a while after that, I suppose of a couple of 3 months, we used to be doing that nearly every day because we were training the pilots.
So so you've passed out, you've got your red beret.
Yeah.
Was that done at a ceremony or...?